You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Staten Island, the latest book from British novelist Tom McCarthy, is the story of a corporate anthropologist who's hired to write what is to be the Great Report, an ethnographic document whose goal is to sum up our era and to plow through the endless amount of available data to create a diagram of the present and a picture of the future. Mr. McCarthy is a visual artist as well as a novelist, and his descriptions, diversions, and deflections will help you envision a very foreign culture, our own. The New York Times Review called it a smart, shimmering, and thought-provoking novel. Alfred A. Knopf publishes Staten Island in this country. I'm very pleased it has brought Tom McCarthy back to our show. Welcome back.
Lovely to be here.
Early on in the book, your narrator says, events, if you want those, you'd best stop reading now. Are you warning the reader not to expect too much plot?
I like the idea of having novels in which nothing happens in a kind of conventional sense of the term. I mean, my first novel, Remainder, has a quite traditional narrative arc that heads towards catastrophe, and yet in that book nothing really happens. Everything that happens is a reenactment or an echo of something else that should be happening but hasn't. And I tried to kind of follow the same logic in this novel of having all these false starts and secondary non-events that create the space for an event that might come but never quite does.
Does it also mean events have ceased to matter, or that only our interpretation of events exists?
Well, we live in this world of endless data, which would be these kind of traces of events. And yet, where is the event? Where can you touch the event? I mean, in this novel, there's an oil slick happening from beginning to end, and my narrator is obsessed with this, but he recognizes that it doesn't even matter where it is or who caused it, because there's always an oil slick happening. Or if there's not, there will be next week, or there has been last night. It's a bit like the car crash for J.G. Ballard. It's a perpetual catastrophe with neither origin nor end.
Has the amount of endless information available to us made our lives deeper and richer, or just more confusing and more cluttered?
I think it's made it the latter, I would say. At the same time, this is, I'm a complete atheist, but this is a theological book. My hero stares at the screen, which is almost like a veil, like a sacred veil. A pixelated veil is one of the first images. And there's this continual hope that the veil will be rent if he analyzes it enough, and from it will pour meaning, the divine grace of meaning. But it never comes.
Your narrator is known only as you, the letter U. Which, of course, is also Y-O-U in text. But is that what you're referring to, or is that a tribute to Kafka?
It was more a tribute to Musil, actually. So as a model for this book,
Robert Musil, the man who wrote
The Man Without Qualities. Absolutely. So this is a doorstopper, 2,000-page novel in which the hero is called Ulrich. And similarly to my guy, he's tasked with, he and his colleagues are tasked with kind of producing modernity as a great spectacular event. They have these salons in which philosophers meet artists, economists, statesmen, and so on, and they all mingle, and nothing happens. And the kind of the gag line that the characters don't know but the reader does is the only event that's going to come is World War One, and they're all kind of screwed. So I wanted to write a minimalist version of that. Instead of 2,000, we have 200 pages. Instead of Ulrich, we have just you. And instead of the 19th century bourgeois salon, we have digital culture. The internet and the corporate think tank is the salon of our day, I'd say.
But isn't it a bit intimidating to know that writers all love Musil, but nobody else reads him?
No, it's good to have a manual. It's like sailors that, you know, sailors all read the Nautical Almanac. We don't need to, but if the captain has, hopefully we'll be safe.
Your novel Sea has been described as your German novel. Remainder is your French novel. Men in Space is your Czech novel. Is Staten Island your first British novel?
Oh, no, it's not a British novel at all. I mean, it ends in Manhattan. I'd say it's to a large extent it's a New York novel, where Moby Dick starts with Ishmael looking in on the Isle of the Manhattoes. This one ends with the exact reverse shot of that, with you looking out from the base of, you know, from the Staten Island ferry port It's almost like the negative that completes that, or the reverse shot that completes that photo. I mean, also a phrase that my hero uses that I stole from Rem Koolhaas is location is irrelevant. What matters is not where somewhere is, but rather where it leads. Mm. And I think the world that it inhabits, the global space it inhabits, is one of connectedness and betweenness and relays. It doesn't really matter whether you're in London or New York or wherever, because you're on Skype.
In Britain, some people have called you the scourge of contemporary aesthetic values. Is that because you haven't written a British novel? Why have you angered them so much? You're a very pleasant
fellow.
That's
a great compliment. Oh, if I didn't anger conservatives, I wouldn't be doing my job properly. It's a compliment. I haven't read any reviews in 5 years of my work. It's quite a nice state to be in. But that's a good one. That's a take-home one.
The cover plays with the ambiguous nature of this book by crossing out phrases like a treatise, an essay, a report, a confession, and a manifesto. The only one not crossed out is a novel.
Yeah.
But you are suggesting that it can be seen in those other ways as well.
I mean, I'm interested in the idea of the negative, the photographic negative, and that literature is a kind of negative space. This is what Mallarmé taught us. This is what Blanchot and Derrida and all those French people understand. And it's, you know, I guess a novel is the thing that it's least not. I mean, it's not a treatise, it's not a confession. So being a novel wouldn't be some positive form. It would be another type of negative, but the least wrong of all these negatives.
Many of the people you cited are philosophers. There have been some philosopher novelists.
Oh, for sure.
You're supposedly a visual artist / novelist. Where's the philosophy come in?
I think it's quite hard to draw the line to say where philosophy ends and literature begins. I mean, isn't Tristram Shandy a huge philosophical treatise? I mean, he spends half the time just writing about Locke. You know, conversely, isn't Derrida's The Postcard an epistolary novel? I mean, it's like Clarissa or something for half the book. So I think it's quite... I mean, this is a tension I was kind of exploiting. I love this passage in Levi-Strauss, in Triste Tropique, where the anthropologist decides that anthropology is rubbish and he should be a great literary artist, and he turns his research notes over and starts writing on the flip side an epic drama in the style of Racine or Corneille, and then he gives up. But, you know, on one side of the paper you've got science, supposedly proper empirical evidence-based research. On the other side you've got epic art, neither of which quite work. And if you could magnify that paper and blow it up 1,000-fold, you'd have this kind of damp, pulpy, no man's land of neither nor, and that would be the space of literature for me.
Well, the big problem for many people who are have a philosophical bent like Sartre is that their novels don't really have the blood of a good novel, and that they're making points.
Sartre's novels don't work. This is true. But someone like Bataille, Lerys, I think there's a more subtle slippage there between. Or Joyce. You know, Joyce is a great...
You think he's a philosopher. Didn't you just do an installation in a London gallery based on this book?
Yes, I just turned the world of this book. It all revolves around an office in a consultancy where my anthropologist has all his diagrams and charts. So I just realized that space with the help of a brilliant set designer, Laura Hopkins, who works with the English National Opera and the Royal Shakespeare Company. She helped me realize this as a 3D space, and we had think tanks inside there and a company report that was just a reading from beginning to end of the whole novel, but staged as a kind of annual report to the shareholders.
My guest is Tom McCarthy. His latest novel is Satin Island. And are you concerned that many New Yorkers will misread it as Staten Island, or is that...
Well, that's a productive slip. I mean,
Satan Island?
Possibly. All those, or Stain, or all those plays and permutations are kind of anticipated in the book, yes.
Well, that's because you also are dealing with certain Freudian ideas.
Oh, sure, yes. Slips.
So there's Freudian slips here.
Absolutely. And just combinations and data reorganizing itself in algorithmic sequences that may or may not kind of reveal something or produce some kind of meaning.
Now, in this book, anthropologists... study corporations. When did anthropologists stop studying the culture of corporations and begin to work for them?
Sometime in the kind of, I guess, around the 70s and 80s, they start. Most big corporations have an anthropologist on
their books.
Is that
a common career path?
More than 50% of anthropology graduates, I am told, end up working in the corporate sector. So then the natives are us, and they're working for Levi, feeding Levi Strauss back into Levi Strauss genes, you know, to get better penetration of a subculture.
What does an anthropologist working for a business actually do?
Analyze the fiber of a kind of the way that meaning is constructed, the weft and warp of its networks of kinship and value system, not just for corporations, but also for governments, for health services who want to understand communities better. I mean, they do some benevolent as well as malevolent work.
But it's a big jump for someone who probably was inspired to become an anthropologist because of Indiana Jones, or someone like your narrator who was inspired by a documentary of people, natives bungee jumping
in the South Pacific Islands. Yes, I mean this. I really wanted to convey a sense of compromise and of being the creative kind of my narrator is not an artist, but maybe he's a stand-in for the figure of the artist or writer. He doesn't stand outside the system. He's right at the heart of the machine of capitalism, power, everything. And I think this is important to think things this way. As writers, we're not outside of this. We're deeply implicated. We're meshed in the system.
And much of the story talks about the problem of truly experiencing something while a part of you is creating the narrative of that experience. That would be true of the writer.
Absolutely. This problem of how to render consciousness as report, as narrative. And this is where the problem of buffering comes up. My narrator becomes obsessed with buffering, that moment where your screen, you know, the circle goes, and you're going, come on. And it's the same. It's a narrative problem, basically. It's about data coming in fast enough to get rendered by this narrative device.
Why not write a novel about a novelist writing his masterpiece rather than an anthropologist doing a report?
That was my initial thought, and then I kind of thought, does the world really need another novel by a white man on top of it all, of about a novelist trying to write a novel about a novelist trying to, etc.? I just thought anthropology is really, really interesting. It's almost like the novelist stripped down to the bare essentials. You look at the world, you report on it. Really simple. And everything else just falls away.
How do companies deal in narratives?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think my hero's boss says what we do here is not product placement or design or consultancy or urban planning. Ultimately, it is fiction. It's about producing narratives that play out in the world and have effects. And I think this is, to a large extent, what business and political and civic and corporate life is about.
Will corporations take over our stories and define them and us? That's one of the fearful themes of this novel.
I think it has already happened. I think that this is a situation we find ourselves. This is a heavily political situation. I mean, there are dominant narratives being produced. The writer's task is not to produce the narratives that shape us. Corporations and governments are doing that. I think the writer's task is maybe to kind of hack those and twist them around and start interrogating and disrupting them.
Instead of us looking to Tolstoy for meaning and interpretation, we'll be looking to Monsanto?
I think the artist's task is almost to sabotage the dominant stories. And I mean, if we look at a writer like William Burroughs, this is how he understood what he was doing. It was a infiltrate virally, cut up, hack up, repaste, reorganize. It's what the surrealists were doing in visual art, kind of just hacking dominant cultural narratives to produce better ones.
One of you's heroes is the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. He talks about Lévi-Strauss's feeling always that he's reached a tribe too late and the experience has already been diminished somehow or interpreted already, that it's no longer pristine. Is that part of the modern dilemma for all of us?
Yes, but Lévi-Strauss is astute enough to realize in that passage that the anthropologist who came here 50 years ago also felt he'd come too late, and that the anthropologist who'll come in 50 more years, inspired by Lévi-Strauss, will think, oh, if only I'd been here when Lévi-Strauss was here, I would have seen what Lévi-Strauss didn't see, but what was right in front of him. And he sees this as an inherent, inbuilt failure of anthropology. There's a The only thing that creates mystique is when the frames of comprehension or analysis are absent. When they're there, mystique goes and the magic goes. It's this kind of, he calls it a double bind that is unresolvable.
We have very little time left, but I wonder why has no one before this realized that Paris is nirvana for rollerbladers?
It's an interesting, I didn't realize this. They in 68, revolutionaries pulled up the cobblestones to throw them at the cops. Then the streets were tarmac so that this could not happen again, which turned it into this, as you say, a paradise for rollerbladers, this smooth, depoliticized space.
And we see a lot of rollerbladers in Paris these days?
You do see a lot of rollerbladers. This is true.
Tom McCarthy is known in the art world for the reports, manifestos, and media interventions he's made as General Secretary of the International Necronautical Society, a semi-fictitious avant-garde network. His previous books include Men in Space, Sea, Remainder, and Tintin and the Secret of Literature. The latest is Satin Island, S-A-T-I-N. It is published in this country by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show
Real pleasure to be here. Nice to see you again.